Welcome to another on-site edition of Don't Miss a Beat. I'm really pleased to be joined by my friend and co-host, Dr. Steve Green. And we're here in the Windy City, and it's living up to its name for the American Heart Association meeting. It's actually a monumental meeting that we actually have two major scientific congresses underway, the ASN Kidney Week happening in Orlando, and the American Heart happening in Chicago. Both are delivering important data in the cardiorenal metabolic space. And so Steve, let's jump right in. Many exciting trials being presented at both of these meetings, but we're just going to select and have time for two of them with very different types of designs and focus. So we'll start with EMPA Kidney. Highly anticipated. EMPA Kidney was the fourth kidney outcomes trial after SCORED, CREDENCE, DAPA-CKD. This was a trial that had many unique elements and was a large outcomes trial. 6,600 patients randomized in this trial to empagliflozin or placebo. And so tell us, Steve, we already had heard that this trial was positive, and in fact, the DSMB had stopped it for overwhelming efficacy, and followed the legacy of DAPA-CKD and CREDENCE, which both were stopped for overwhelming efficacy. So a lot of high anticipations coming in. What are some of the unique elements of the patient population that this trial assessed?
Yep, I think that's something a very notable feature with EMPA Kidney. So one, the prior CKD trials that you were noting, Mutu, we are completely among diabetic patients or had a majority of patients with diabetes. So EMPA Kidney actually had the majority of patients with non-diabetic CKD, so something very important to note because we had very limited numbers of patients in the non-diabetic CKD group. Other key feature to know about EMPA Kidney is it did not require albuminuria. So the criteria for EMPA Kidney were either a GFR of 20 to 45, irrespective of albuminuria, including no albuminuria, or 45 to 90 with your GFR with albuminuria of at least 200 on your UACR. So including non-albuminuric CKD, and actually about 20% of the enrolled patient population had less than 30, so micro or no albuminuria at all. And the other unique feature about this is going back to those GFR criteria we just mentioned. Enrolled people with GFRs as low as 20 at baseline. So again, DAPA-CKD did include some patients less than 30 in the GFR, down to as low as 25. CREDENCE had a GFR of 30, where they went down to, but now really it was over about a third of patients that were enrolled had a GFR of less than 30 at the kidney.
Yeah, so this was the sickest trial population in terms of kidney health at baseline. And if you recall the really 5x3 KDIGO heat map,
yep,
in which we have stages of CKD on the y-axis and on the x-axis albuminuria, most of the kidney outcomes trials had focused in this high albuminuria with moderate stage kidney disease group of patients, and with average albuminuria in the 1,000 range across DAPA-CKD, CREDENCE, and SCORED. Here, we have much lower levels of albuminuria because of that sizable group without albuminuria. So critically important.
It really rounds out the whole picture for SGLT2 inhibition across the range of CKD, the real spectrum here. I mean, like you mentioned, like the UACR, like, you know, mean UACR in DAPA-CKD is around the 900 range here. Here, we're in the median or in the 300 range, including that large group with no albuminuria at all. So it really kind of rounds out the full spectrum for SGLT2 inhibition in the spectrum of CKD.
All right. So trial stopped early by the DSMB. Positive primary outcome, which was the traditional renal composite endpoint of a substantial eGFR decline, need for dialysis or other measures of kidney failure, but also included a cardiovascular component, and that's cardiovascular death, recognizing that this is such an at-risk population and cardiovascular causes of death are in fact the most frequent mode of death in this population. So met that endpoint by a large degree reduction, over a 20% reduction is that endpoint. What about some of the secondary endpoints and other endpoints? Did the SGLT2 inhibitor modify those endpoints?
So it reduced all-cause hospitalizations, which I think is a very clinically relevant endpoint. So irrespective of cause, this was total and recurrent all-cause hospitalizations. It was statistically significant. The other endpoints actually, so looking at like CV death or heart failure hospitalization, all-cause death, they were directionally favorable with empagliflozin versus placebo, but did not achieve statistical significance. I think part of this is indeed related, though, to the low event rates from a cardiovascular outcome perspective. We talked about the kidney health of these patients, so they had lower GFRs, mean GFRs in the 37 range or so, but the albuminuria was much lower, so those were kind of a push and pull when you think about risk from a kidney perspective. But just looking at the raw event rates, it was a lower risk patient population. When you look at even the placebo event rates for all-cause death, cardiovascular death. So I think part of that may be empower prevented statistical significance, but again, directionally consistent.
And is that your thought related to the heart failure outcome? Because if I recall, heart failure hospitalization or cardiovascular death, the endpoint that has really been significantly reduced in nearly every one of the type 2 diabetes CV outcomes trials, chronic kidney disease trials, and the heart failure trials, missed significance and was not robustly reduced in this trial. So is this a power issue from your perspective?
Probably. I mean, meta-analyses, I think you were a part of a meta-analysis that actually maybe came out today, very likely, although I haven't seen the data yet, I'm guessing there's going to be no statistical significantly heterogeneity in treatment effect. And again, the story seems very consistent. I think in the context of everything we know about SGLT2 inhibitors and CKD, and again, recognizing just by looking at the placebo event rates from a cardiovascular and heart failure risk perspective, this was a lower risk patient population than DAPA CKD and some of the other trials from a cardiovascular outcome perspective.
Perfect. So subgroup data were actually fairly revealing here and somewhat interesting, and in each of the SGLT2 inhibitor trials, subgroup data have been somewhat boring and pleasantly boring, that these showed largely consistent findings across every demographic or clinical parameter. Here, there were really three groups that were of critical significance. So one was GFR. This tested a broad range of eGFR. Does the drug provide kidney disease progression protection across that range? And the answer seems to be yes.
Yep.
The second was albuminuria. And you had mentioned that a sizable group of patients had no albuminuria, a group of patients that really never been represented. And at least directionally so, there was relatively neutral effects in that subgroup, of course. This is in the context of very low event rates, and so even the interaction terms may be underpowered due to those lower event rates. And the third group is diabetes. This is again now enhancing the representation of the population. We haven't learned too much about non-diabetic kidney disease, and in fact, again, a borderline interaction of P of 0.06, in which there was perhaps more neutral effects in the non-diabetic group. So, it could all be a power issue,
yeah,
as you said. In general, I would have anticipated similar relative reductions and perhaps wider confidence limits in the context of lower event rates. I do wonder if albuminuria is really a critical determinant of not only as a prognostic factor for determining cardiovascular and kidney outcomes, but also in terms of treatment response. And unfortunately, we don't have great data in the heart failure trials related to albuminuria. In fact, they weren't systematically collected in some of the trials, like the most recent DELIVER. So what do you think this is going to mean in terms of dissemination of this data? Do you think people are going to look into these subgroups?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting thought. I mean, I'm curious to see what you'll think of this. I mean, obviously it generates the hypothesis that you know, very low levels of albuminuria or no albuminuria, maybe attenuates benefit with SGLT2 inhibitors. But, you know, and we don't have another trial with SGLT2 inhibitors in this population, which is a unique subset of patients included in EMPA kidney. So I think from a totality of evidence perspective, I do not think we're going to be restricting SGLT2 inhibitors in patients without albuminuria, but I think it's certainly going to be something to see if any other future studies, whether even small mechanistic studies or whatnot, can support you know, what we should do with decision making. Certainly, it seems like there are lower risk patient populations, so like numbers needed to treat, absolute risk reductions will be impacted. You know, I know we're also talking to you, I think you had mentioned like some of the finerenone data in terms of like studying patients with CKD with low albuminuria. Yes. I don't know, obviously two different therapies here, but I'm wondering from, you know, just overall therapeutic benefit perspective, that can give you any inferences.
No, and that is how the KDIGO guidelines are now structured.
Yeah.
In fact, in a patient with type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, foundational therapy after lifestyle management with an SGLT2 inhibitor or a RAS inhibitor, such as an ACE inhibitor or ARB, is recommended. If the patient has persistent evidence of albuminuria above 30 milligrams per gram, then the patient may be a candidate for finerenone. So it really does position albuminuria as an important measure in determining treatment candidacy. You know, the one adjacent population that we do have data from is the DECLARE population. Mm. So DECLARE was a type 2 diabetes population with broad risk and had robust UACR data. And in fact, there, across a broad spectrum of UACR, there was persistent cardiovascular outcome benefit. Prevention of heart failure persisted even at low albuminuria levels. So my big concern about limiting treatments in patients with no albuminuria and chronic kidney disease is that we may be precluding their potential cardiovascular benefits from this class of therapies.
I think exactly as you're saying, I think important to note that in the New England Journal publication in the main table for interaction, it's about that progression of kidney disease, cardiovascular death outcome. Yet to see the data on things like all-cause hospitalization and things that are also very, very clinically relevant. So I think, I agree, I think we should err on not restricting or overplaying this interaction analysis that we're seeing.
All right, Steve. You and your colleagues presented the leading trial that led off AHA Sessions 2022, Transform Heart Failure. Another highly, highly anticipated one that we had all looked forward to because it answered a fundamental question, which diuretic may be most beneficial in our care of patients recently hospitalized for heart failure. So tell us in a 30-second bullet, what is the overall aim and kind of design of the trial?
So it was a pragmatic strategy trial of patients hospitalized for heart failure, irrespective of ejection fraction, that had a plan for a continued use of a loop diuretic in their hospitalized high-risk patient population, excluded patients with end-stage kidney disease on dialysis, but very minimal other exclusions. And they were randomized to the strategy of furosemide or Lasix, torsemide, also called Demodex, okay, to be initiated by the time of discharge, continued post-discharge, okay, dosing at the discretion of the treating clinician. So it was really randomizing the strategy of which agent to pick, but the dosing was at the discretion of the clinician.
Excellent. So tell us about the size of the trial. That changed during the course of the trial, and why was that changed?
So we had anticipated, based on our initial projections, enrolling up to 6,000 patients. But you know, as we're going through the trial, which started in June of 2018, we realized that our event rates, and this is what the DSMB was seeing too, was very, very high. And this was an event-driven trial. We were targeting, for the primary endpoint, which we haven't got to yet, which was all-cause mortality, we were targeting 721 deaths. And because it's an event-driven trial and our event rate was higher than anticipated, we were getting to that event number much quicker. So at the time of earlier this year, in 2022, just in March, the DSMB had reviewed the data, reviewed the events that had been accrued, and acknowledged there had been significant events and get good scientific validity to address the question at hand.
Excellent, excellent. So you said that death was the primary endpoint, and that's a unique endpoint, of course, perhaps one of the most important, if not the most important endpoint, and was the primary endpoint for a number of historical trials in heart failure. We've moved towards disease-specific endpoints. So talk us through the rationale for selection of all-cause mortality.
No, it's a very, very good question. So one, this was a pragmatic strategy-based trial. So in part, what we had to do was make a trial that, again, could be completed on a very, on a more modest budget than what you're seeing in a usual industry-sponsored trial. This was funded by the NIH. And also because of these are two generic drugs that are freely available in just routine standard of care, the trial was open label. Again, part of being the pragmatic feature of this to, again, enroll patients and keep do it in a relatively modest sized budget. So it's open label. So whenever you have an open label strategy-based trial, you have to ask yourself, well, about what endpoint you pick, is it vulnerable to bias? And all-cause mortality is really, if you're a purist, the ultimate of endpoints, but also the endpoint that is most really resistant to any kind of bias. What I mean by that is if you chose like a endpoint like hospitalization as your primary or a disease-specific or even like a PRO, for example, as primary, obviously everyone knows, the patients know, the clinicians know which therapy they're getting. If there's an inclination that one therapy is considered inferior based on some bias, maybe that predisposes patients to a differential effect on a patient-reported outcome or hospitalization. So really, for both pragmatism and also the open label nature, that's what necessitated the all-cause mortality as the primary endpoint.
Perfect. So strong rationale there. Tell us about the overall trial conduct. So this was conducted in the United States, about how many sites did you enroll from, and what was the kind of population makeup of the group?
Oh, that's a great question. I think we're very proud of this. This was a U.S.-only trial, 60 U.S. sites. We enrolled, randomized 2,859 patients in from 2018 June to March of 2022. So less than 4 years in a U.S. trial. That's the key thing. The average patient clinical trial enrollment in the United States for a typical trial, it's about 0.2 to 0.3 patients per site per month. We were on average for this trial more than 2 patients per site per month throughout the entire trial, which included the COVID pandemic, of course, where enrollment did dip, but it still were able to power through and complete enrollment answer the question. So again, we're really proud of that feature. And again, I think part of the reason why we were able to get through the COVID pandemic with, again, still a steady stream of enrollment was because of the pragmatic feature of the follow-up, which we haven't touched on yet. But it was a centralized follow-up through the DCRI call center and just the DCRI coordinating center, where there was, as part of the study, after they left the hospital, there was no mandatory in-person study-specific visits. Patients followed up per usual care, and for the primary endpoint of all-cause death, we ascertained that by, one, calling the patients and talking to surrogates through the DCRI call center, but two, actually using the National Death Index. So, which has been proven to be a very reliable measure for determining all-cause death. So again, it was a centralized follow-up strategy, so no extra burden on patients in terms of extra visits to an office or lab checks, no extra burden on the site investigators in terms of after the patient left the index hospitalization, there was no extra follow-up tasks to the site investigators. So I think those pragmatic features really lowered the barrier to participation at both the site level and the patient level. I think allowed us to have a very diverse, generalizable patient population enrolled and actually do it in pretty timely fashion.
Yes, wonderful demonstration of pragmatic trial conduct, especially in the United States, which has really been a challenging area, region to enroll from. Okay, so tell us about the fidelity of randomization. So, randomization in this type of trial is subject to crossover or, in some cases, protocol violations or deviations. And so, how did you do during that 12-month interval in follow-up for endpoint assessment?
So for so in terms of missing data and whatnot, we had very minimal missing data for the primary endpoint by virtue of National Death Index. So not an issue there. I would argue by for even the secondary endpoint, which was all-cause mortality or all-cause hospitalization or total all-cause hospitalizations, really missing data, not an obvious problem there in terms of our event capture. But we do have, you know, challenges, because I think this kind of gets to your question of, you know, pragmatic design and things, understanding adherence to the randomized therapy and this crossover issue. So I think one issue that we had, I think, is, again, it's an opportunity for growth for future pragmatic trials, just confirming what you know, whether they were on the randomized therapy or not, just knowing the diuretic status period. You know, we at 30 days, you know, we were unable to actually validate what the known diuretic status was in about 30% of patients. So, you know, it doesn't mean they crossed over, it just means we didn't know.
Yes,
we
yes.
just didn't know. But when you look at the patients that we did know, so we were able to get a hold of them by phone, which was the metric we were looking for, both outcome assessment and also this adherence, you know, we were able to get a hold of about 60 or 65% of the patients. And crossover rate at 30 days was about 7%. And it was actually, you know, directionally both ways. That includes going from furosemide to torsemide, torsemide to furosemide. You know, actually, you know, just numerically, it was more common to cross over at the 30-day time point from torsemide to furosemide, actually, which is kind of contrary to what maybe some of us thought. We were, I think there's this bias that maybe, you know, torsemide is a more effective diuretic, or in terms of congestion, people that might switch that way. But actually, it makes you think, too, was there just a, you know, whether it was a cost issue or just a logistical issue with confusion that actually had a numerically higher crossover rate going from torsemide back to furosemide. But it was about 7% in 30 days. There's also patients that came off that loop diuretic altogether. Well, among the patients where we actually knew the loop diuretic, you know, 7%, again, approximately at 30 days, were on no loop diuretic at all. So again, these kind of things, you know, err on the side of making the trial tendency for neutrality, and certainly may have contributed. Although, again, we also did on-treatment analysis of sensitivity that were pre-specified. And there, we did see consistent results with the ITT results. So, again, it suggests that adherence, at least by the on-treatment analysis that have been currently done, there might be some more post-hoc analyses that we look at. But at least those on-treatment analyses that were pre-specified did not change any of the study conclusions.
Perfect. And did COVID-19 affect the trial?
So we haven't done that yet in terms of looking at a COVID analysis, but it's a great question. I know we saw other trials presented at AHA, like an Ironman trial.
Yes.
You know, we've seen with Affirm and GUIDE-HF some of these analyses where clearly, you know, for these marginal p-values for primary endpoints, you do the COVID analysis and it you know, moves things directionally towards statistical significance. So you know, we'll have to see. I mean, in fairness, though, our primary endpoint all-cause mortality was not anywhere close to being statistically significant. You know, even our secondary endpoint of all-cause mortality or all-cause hospitalization,
yes.
According to that statistical analysis plan, we're actually targeting a p-value of 0.005. We're actually calling that statistically significant. So again, we'll have to wait and see what the COVID analysis shows, but hasn't been performed yet.
Got it. Okay, so covered a lot of material about these two trials. Anything else to add about TRANSFORM before we conclude?
So I think one piece of information that we haven't assessed yet in TRANSFORM, we're still diving deep into the data, is the patient-reported outcome piece.
Mm.
So KCQ, and actually there was a PHQ-2 endpoint looking at screening for depression. So I think, you know, as compared to, you know, some of our therapies with trials with novel therapies, where the bar is high for both regulatory approval and for adoption into practice, you know, these are two generic therapies, and the bar is low, I think, to change our practice.
Yes.
So we'll have to wait and see what the PRO data might suggest, because again, I think trials like TRANSFORM, they're very pragmatic. One, they're very generalizable, but two, again, these are two very routinely used therapies. If we are able to find a benefit or suggestion of benefit, it might be enough to move the needle, and it might make sense. The other thing that I'll say about TRANSFORM is, in terms of its interpretation, is that we have to understand this was patients that were, by inherent nature of the trial, where there was equipoise inside of the investigator to decide could they go with furosemide or torsemide. I think this doesn't necessarily address a few key situations. It does not address the patients that are clearly failing furosemide, for example, which is the most commonly used loop diuretic in practice, and whether you should switch or keep them on furosemide. So that is not addressed in TRANSFORM, so we'll have to, you know, think about that that clinical situation with further evidence. And two, it also doesn't get at the dosing question. I think we answered that in this trial. The routine use of one versus the other doesn't seem to make a meaningful difference on death or hospitalization. But dosing, how dosing maybe impacted the effect that we saw here, or a lack of effect, what is the optimal, you know, dose equivalency of these two types of diuretics? I think those kind of questions still remain to be answered.
Wonderful, wonderful discussion. And congratulations again, Steve, to you, your colleagues, and of course, to the investigators and participants of the trial. Remarkable feat to be able to complete this trial so efficiently, and in the United States with such a diverse enrollment. So that wraps up this live episode of Don't Miss a Beat. You can catch each of the episodes on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, as well as live recordings on practicalcardiology.com, your news station for the latest in cardiorenal metabolism.